For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you so very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff, at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. So I hope everybody is safe and they've been able to dig out of the snow and the ice and whatever else is going on with them. I know there's been a lot of accidents and a lot of crazy stuff going on. So I hope everybody's okay with that. For me, I am on day one of a 5-day fast. I've had really good results with fasting, and I ate, I think it was about four or five metric tons of sugar over the holiday. And I really need to get a handle on that. So hopefully that'll offer a nice little reset for me, get my metabolism and my body right, get that insulin resistance fixed and all that other good stuff. Okay. Well, today we have got episode 125, and this is going to be my 2025 Varroa strategy with a couple of updates in there as well. We got a lot to talk about, and I could probably reverse this. I probably should have, to be honest with you. The episode that I'm going to record later this week is going to be all about Varroa and, you know, making sure that you, again, as part of our, you know, new beekeeper series that we're working on here, kind of doing a bit of a deep dive into Varroa and how important it is and how critical it is that you're treating for this. Anyway, I've already gone through that several times before, but I'm not going to let up on it. This is going to be the one thing that you're going to hear me say all the time. If you are thinking in your mind, Jeff, please stop talking about Varroa, I get it. That means that I've done my job, because it has to be on the forefront. But today, I'm going to go over my strategy, all the things that I'm looking to implement, the reasoning kind of behind that strategy. And like I said, that'll get us kind of prepped and set for the next episode, which is 126. Kind of diving into everything with that. So one thing that is consistent in beekeeping is change. Now, I know that sometimes I can kind of sound a bit like a politician by the way that I occasionally change positions on something, but usually if there is a position that I've taken for whatever reason, there's usually a really good reason behind it. If I switch that position or something changes with it, there's also a good reason behind that. And it's not so much, I mean, from time to time, there have been, you know, situations and scenarios where I was under the impression that something was done a certain way and it was not, so I didn't do my due diligence. There has been times where somebody has, who I trusted and respected, said, hey, this is the way this should be. And I thought, okay, well, this person knows, they've been doing this forever, and they were wrong. There have been times where things within the industry itself have changed. Resistance to certain treatments have changed. Methodologies, approaches, things that we once held to be true have been found to not be true. This is just something that happens in a lot of areas and a lot of different spaces, and it happens with beekeeping as well. If you are a person who likes to operate in a very static and controlled environment where things don't change, you may want to reevaluate your decision to pursue a hobby in beekeeping. It is ever-changing. That's one of the things I love most about it. I don't love it when I lose bees. I don't like it when bad things happen. But every time you go into a hive, every time you're doing an inspection on your colonies, you get a chance to see something new and different. There's always something different. And I think that it helps to keep you on your toes, but it keeps you developing. It keeps your brain sharp. It keeps you always trying to find creative ways of solving problems. It's very engaging. So that's one of the things I really like about it. But the point that I was trying to get at with this is, while I do occasionally change my position on something, or I may shift a little bit. The foundation of beekeeping remains the same. Yes, the variables are changing, but for example, it's not like, hey guys, I got some new information to put out for you today. Now there are four types of bees in the hive. It's not just the queen, workers, and drones. There's a new type. It's not going to happen. We're not going to all of a sudden have, you know, a new cast of bees, you know, within the hive. And one thing that it really doesn't make it easier is when people in the beekeeping community, particularly those who are trying to educate and teach others, they get so wrapped up into the money and the financial side of it that a lot of times they produce content that is either absolutely useless or completely irrelevant. But they know that if, as an example, they have a monetized YouTube channel and they throw out a relatively useless video, they'll at least get so many thousands of views, they'll make a few dollars, even if that video brings absolutely no value to beekeepers and beekeeping as a trade. Now, I'm not going to get into the specifics. I'm not going to throw anybody under the bus, but I've been watching a lot of YouTube primarily because I'm kind of an addict to it. There's just so much information. Like, I used to play chess as a kid, and I played a lot of chess. And there was this guy who, it's kind of a long story, but he was a friend of the family, excellent chess player. And he was the only one who regularly beat me. He always beat me. But I always learned. Every time I played him, I became a better player because he was so good. I don't know how it happened, but something popped up on my feed and it was like, oh, something about chess. And I watched this video and now I'm sucked in and I'm playing chess again online. But there's just so much information on YouTube. It drives me nuts that I can get down that little rabbit hole of watching things sometimes. But there has been a ridiculous amount of garbage on YouTube lately. And that garbage does nothing more than complicate relatively simple things. And it makes you worry about things you have no business worrying about. And I would really like to talk about this, but I'm trying to extend some professional courtesy out there to some of these people because I know they're smart people and I don't think they're bad people. But I'm like, why in the world would you do this? But regardless of the experts who are filling your YouTube, you know, video feed with not so important information, and I'm not picking on everybody. A lot of the information is very, very good, but there are some very prominent people lately who've been putting out some weird junk. You have to constantly be reassessing your needs and the needs of your bee yard in order to stay ahead of things. So here's an example. I don't change or adapt my strategy when I don't have a need to do so. So whatever the alleged problem might be, I may mention that I've heard of something, but it hasn't, you know, presented itself as a problem to me. I'm not necessarily going to advocate for or against a solution or an approach. I just may not have a lot of information on it because I don't use it. So as an example that I wanted to give here is the quilt box. There are tens and thousands of people who swear by quilt boxes. Every time I see one, all I have is a vision in my mind of three or four pregnant mice living in them all winter, rearing their own brood. But like our friend Randy Oliver said, if you're using them for insulation and to absorb moisture, they're useless when they get wet. Now, as you know, I'm a huge proponent of my block of foam insulation, which does a tremendous job of keeping things insulated, reducing excessive moisture. But the shift that I've been trying to make is one where instead of me trying to steer someone away from something that maybe I don't have a lot of experience with and that I don't think makes any sense at all, I'm trying to look at it more as, will this cause any major issues? So it may not benefit anything, but does it actually hurt anything? And if it's not going to hurt anything, then I'm really trying not to give somebody a hard time. But as you know, I'm still never, ever giving bees granulated sugar. I'm still dying on that hill, and I'm not going to let, I got to do it again. So 5 pounds of sugar. It takes about 5 pounds of granulated sugar to make a deep frame of capped honey. So you have a group of honeybees. They're in a cluster. Let's just say you have a double brood box kind of setup. They're in the upper brood box with all the honey, but they're running out. And they say, hey, you know what? I'm going to break the cluster where it's nice and warm and cozy, and I'm going to go way up to the very top of this hive, find this sugar, these granules of sugar. Now, keeping in mind that if you put these in the hive in the summertime, you're going to find it all over the ground outside the hive because they don't want it. But now it's up there in this section. So maybe you're putting, let's say, 5 pounds or another. You want to get 2 deep frames worth of capped honey, right? And if you had this as sugar syrup and you took 2 of these 5-pound bags, that would get you 2 frames roughly of capped honey. So you can take 10 pounds of granulated sugar, stick it in the top of this thing. That will never convert to becoming 2 frames of honey. But play along. They leave the cluster, they go up into this upper area, and they find the granulated sugar. Now they're relying on a couple of things. There either has to be a ton of excess moisture that has now dripped down on that, that at least gets it to a point where they can drink some of it up. But they got to make sure they do that before it gets too cold, because if it's like 45, if it's less than, you know, 50 degrees, they're not going to be really excited to be up there. It gets down to around 45 Fahrenheit, like around 7 degrees Celsius. They're physically not going to be able to move. So if it's colder in that upper area for any reason, they're going to go up there to get a snack and they're going to die. But let's assume it's just 90 degrees. Nice and cozy, no problem. It's like cluster level temperature up there. So now they're going to go up in there. If there's not enough moisture, they've got to then kind of salivate onto it, or they've got to go get moisture from inside the hive, bring it back to this sugar, salivate onto the sugar to hopefully dissolve it enough to where they can actually absorb some of it. And in that scenario, with those 10 pounds of sugar, those 2 deep frames, if fully used in sugar syrup, that's going to save the day. That's going to save the hive. If you have your colonies so depleted at the end of the season that it is a 1 to 2 frame like survivability, that it's February, March in the Northern Hemisphere, and you're like, whew, they had 1 frame left. We just made it. If that's your norm, you're not doing things right. You're not beekeeping in the way you should be. You're not taking care of your bees. What's probably happening is you want honey so badly that you've decided to take a bunch of honey in the spring, maybe even in the fall too, didn't leave them with enough. You fed them whatever you wanted to feed them in the fall, and you thought they had enough, and now this sugar or these candy boards or the people who sell the candy boards, again, same example, how many actual calories are going into that to where if they consumed the entire thing, it's going to save the colony? I haven't put anything in a beehive in a decade, and my bees overwinter. Why? I don't steal all of their honey. If you're going to take a little bit, take a little bit. Start out year one. Don't take any in the first year. In year two, maybe take a frame or two. See how much is left at the end of year one to make a decision about year two. Spend time with your hives. Become a good beekeeper. If honey is the big driver, don't even pick up beekeeping. Just go buy it. It's so much cheaper to just support your local, you know, your local apiary, your local bee club, your local bee farmer, whoever has honey. Go buy honey from them. It's 20 times cheaper. But all of these life support things are only happening from basically it's 2 reasons. You either took too much from your bees in that season, whenever the foraging season was in, you know, from in our area, you know, March, April through October, or your bees are in an area that does not have sufficient forage for them to thrive, not just to get by and to survive, but to actually thrive within an environment. But everybody under the sun, gotta have sugar, gotta have this, gotta have that. I don't know, man. Look in a tree. What's in a tree? I don't think there's big packs of granulated sugar and candy boards and fondant and all that kind of stuff up in the trees. But again, this is the hill I've decided to die on. So here I am. Okay. So all of this being said, my recommendation that this is one that you've heard me say several times before. I say, keep bees your way. They're your bees. So if you feel like the best thing for your bees, for their health, for their well-being, is to rob all their honey out, feed the hell out of them in the fall, give them a bunch of candy and stuff that they'll drink 25 or 50% out of over the winter, and they survive, and they appear to be healthy, and you don't have a lot of issues with disease, then do what makes you happy. I think you're going to spend a lot of money. I think you're going to compromise the bees' health. I think you're going to waste a lot in that process. But if that's what you want to do and you can afford to do it, then do it. But I would encourage you for everything, regardless of, you know, whether you have one hive, 20 hives, whatever, keep doing research. Keep looking for new information. Listen to me, but then go out and get, you know, the opinions of other people on things that are particularly important. And then you can realize that I was right all along and that you don't need those other people. No. In all seriousness, though, listen to what I say. Listen to what someone else says. And that's where I would love to hear. If you're like, hey, Jeff, I was listening to Bob Smith over here, and he says that the best way to do this is this and that. And I might say, yeah, you know, where Bob is, that's a really common practice, and that's not a bad idea. Not really necessary here or there, but listen to what other people have to say. Take it with a grain of salt and then become the beekeeper that's right for you and where you are. And challenge people, you know, say, hey, listen, like I said, you know, you see this discrepancy, you're trying to figure, you're not trying to make anyone look bad. You're not trying to throw anybody in the bus. You're not trying to hurt anyone's feelings. The field and hobby is filled with misinformation or things that are maybe, like I said, the best approach in one place, not necessarily somewhere else. But I'm going to give you an example from our Discord room the other day. Somebody came in and was chatting with us, good discussion, and somebody had raised the question, like, hey, when do you look at your bees in the winter? How often do you check them in the winter? And I had commented, I've never opened a beehive in December or January. Now, I'm talking about where I live. We've had bees overwintering in Florida, outside of Orlando. We've had some down there that we've obviously opened, you know, year-round, depending on what's going on. But this guy had commented, he's like, oh, yeah, I opened mine up in December. And I was like, what? You know, and I was like, no, December. Like, and then I realized, oh, that's right. He's in Tampa. So it's a whole different environment when you're in anywhere in Florida, really. And even the deep South, I mean, you're down in, you know, Texas, Mississippi, Arizona, you're in the South. You can get a lot of really, really warm days in the wintertime. That's not unusual at all. So again, it goes back to knowing your area. So as you're looking for information and you're evaluating what people are saying, keep in mind that a lot of people don't necessarily give the disclaimer of like, hey, I'm in Nebraska and this is what I do. They're just saying, hey, I'm a beekeeper and this is what I do. Like I mentioned several times, my friend in Nebraska wraps his beehives every winter, right? And it works great for him. They have no issues overwintering. I've never wrapped a hive. Am I wrong because I've never wrapped a hive? No, I don't think I'm wrong at all, because my average daily temperature in the wintertime is probably like 38 or 39 Fahrenheit, so like 2 degrees Celsius or whatever it is. His average temperatures are probably like 8 or something like that. It's a lot colder out there. That makes sense. But you also have to, you know, keep in mind too that things will change. There are some things that are very static, like we talked about earlier, but there are things that are going to change, so you do want to kind of try to stay on top of things. You may have somebody advocating, for example, for a Varroa treatment that's really great, and they did this video or a podcast or a discussion, you know, 5-6 years ago, and that's completely off the market. There was an EPA issue, they pulled it, or there was a change to the formula because of resistance and it's no longer available. So things are going to change, which again is why you got to stay on top of things. And try not to be, you know, too tough on someone who gets it wrong, because I don't really believe there's anyone out there in the bee community that is willfully, intentionally trying to mislead anyone. But there are more topics and areas of discussion and research in honeybees than anything I've ever been a part of. I've been doing this for about 14 years. I learn every day. And it's a combination of me continuing to read. It's people emailing and asking me questions. I feel like I'm about, I don't know, 92, 95% of them I have an answer for, but there are some weird things that come up sometimes. And I think, geez, I've never heard that before. I've got to go do research, and that helps me to get better. So, I mean, I'm learning, I feel like I'm learning just as much from all of you as I am from any research that I do. And I love that. I love the engagement, the questions, you know, but like I said, just take things with a grain of salt when you don't necessarily know the source, and challenge people, challenge them in a respectful way. Everybody who is credible, I would say, should be willing to engage in some dialogue. Okay, so that's enough of my kind of rant on that.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Let me tell you about the approach that I'm taking for Varroa management this year. In the past, I've kind of been all over the map. And when I say all over the map, not so much with products, but with my consistency. And it was really bad in those early years. I've gotten better, but it was really bad in the early years. But I primarily started with Apivar. It was really easy. You go into the hive, you put the strips on, you leave them there for a month, you take them off, and you're done. And then you can, you know, reassess, reapply again as needed. And that was good. And I had pretty good, you know, efficacy with that. You do have the issues with treating, you know, when honey supers are on. So you've got to, you know, get those off or recognize that that's honey that is staying for the bees. But again, you know, it's easy to use. It is kind of expensive. I don't really like that. But when I worked with a commercial guy a few years ago, he showed me everything, you know, under the sun about how his OA system that he was using and how he administered it. And we were able to do so many hives so fast, and it was really, really cheap. Again, once you get past that initial investment of the equipment. So I made the shift over to that and kind of standardized on that. Now, oxalic acid is a little bit more gentle. It's kind of a gentler approach. There are things out there that are very aggressive. When you have a really challenging infestation, when your mite counts are really, really high, you're probably going to need to get more aggressive. You're going to need to have a few other things kind of in the toolbox. You know, best practices is probably going to tell you that you're going to need to have at least two methods available that'll help you kind of reduce the likelihood of those mites developing a resistance. Or even if they did develop a resistance to one of them, you know, hopefully the other one kind of knocks them down. If you're using the same thing over and over and over again, you know, over time, there is a possibility that you have mites that can develop a resistance to something. So while there may not be a broad, you know, national or global resistance to oxalic acid, you may have some resistance that's local to you. What I would say is if you're using, again, let's say you're using oxalic acid and you're like, Jeff, that's all I use. I love it. It's working great. That's fine. Keep an eye on your counts. And if your mite counts start to get high, you definitely want to consider something else. If you start out with a really high count, oxalic acid can help bring it down. It may not knock it down enough. So that's, again, where you may need to get more aggressive. Now, like I said, a lot of industry experts are going to tell you, you got to be using at least two different things no matter what, because you want to stay ahead of that resistance. And I'm not going to disagree with them. I mean, I have this vision in my mind of, you know, a colony that's being treated. They are resistant. They become this super bug, you know, factory varroa bomb, basically, because they just like drink the oxalic acid and they don't care. And now you've got varroa all over the place. You have this new varroa or this new treatment resistant mite that's running around, and that certainly makes things more difficult for everybody in your area. So that makes a lot of sense. Now, like I said, if you talk to anybody who manufactures, you know, oxalic acid, people who are using it, I've not heard anyone yet say that there is a national or global or even regionally recognized resistance to OA yet. Is it possible? Yes. I'm sure there are some that have said, hey, look, within my yard, it's not working anymore. Absolutely possible. I'm not aware of it. But in an effort to kind of practice what I preach, I am going to bring something else in this year, and I'm not really sure where I want to go. You know, the strips are okay for just a few hives, regardless of what you're using. You know, a strip-based approach is fine. I'm fascinated by Randy Oliver's OA pads. I think those are kind of interesting. But yeah, I just haven't settled on what my number two is going to look like for this year. More to follow on that one. But as it relates to oxalic acid, here's kind of what I've settled on for 2025. The first treatment of the year for me is going to be in April. Now, if I can catch a nice day and, you know, late March, early April, I want to definitely get a mite count there beforehand. But regardless of what's going on, there's going to be a treatment that's going to happen in April. I really want that to be a part of this kind of new beekeeper series we've been working on here. Now, that's not like, you know, the official name. I'm not branding it as that. I'm not throwing that onto anything. It's integrated into the other episodes and everything. But from time to time, we do get a donation on the Buy Me a Coffee. So from now until the end of March, March 31st, 100% of everything that comes in through that is going towards buying new package bees that are going to be used, 100% dedicated for podcast education, testing, trying out things that you all want to see, buying treatments for them. So I did want to pass that along to everybody. One thing that is really great with packaged bees is there is no brood. Okay. And as we know, you know, mites reproduce inside of the brood cells. So if there's no brood, there's nowhere for them to hide. One thing I'm thinking about doing this year for my packages of bees is taking a bucket and making a hole somewhere, you know, in the front of it, on the lid specifically, and then slide the package of bees into the bucket. And then through that hole, I'll administer an oxalic acid treatment prior to ever even installing them into the new hive. So that would kind of be my plan for treatment number one. Because again, this is tied to the new beekeepers. They're getting everything brand new. They don't even have their hive completely ready to go yet. So we get that treatment done. And then the next day, boom, we're installing into the new hive. Now, with these package bees, I won't pull honey in year number one. But the second treatment would be right after I would normally pull my honey supers. So if you're pulling honey supers in like late May, early June, once the honey is off, and again, you can treat with oxalic acid with the honey supers on. I don't need to do so. I will go ahead and treat again after I pull the honey supers. And what ends up happening is when those come off, it should be getting pretty close to our dearth. So if I pull some earlier, you know, I may end up having an extra treatment in there somewhere. But if the counts are looking good, I'll probably let them go until mid-June. In mid-June, we have a dearth. The queen stops laying eggs. I shouldn't say she stops laying eggs. The technical thing would be the colony ceases to rear new brood. The queen might be laying eggs, but they're still being cannibalized by the nurse bees. But during that dearth, when they are not raising new brood, is a great time to treat, because that way the mites, the varroa mites, have nowhere to hide, and you're more likely to have some better effectiveness with the treatment. Then I'm going to go again in that August and October timeframe. So August, you know, July, we're going to do a mite count. We'll do another count in August. But that's where you really got to start paying attention, because that August through October timeframe, that's when you're building up your winter bees. That's when the problems that you had in the spring and the summer are now visible. It's not unusual at all for people to have decent looking mite numbers, you know, coming out of the spring or early spring, and then the mite numbers explode. They do a few treatments in October. They're like, oh yeah, my numbers are looking great. But your viral load is through the roof, right? We can talk in more detail about this later on, but that would be my my plan there. To, you know, again, checking in August, treating again probably in October, and then I'm gonna hit them one more time while they're in the hive in December, and that's just kind of like a end of season farewell. Oxalic acid is really inexpensive once you have the hardware to administer it, so it's kind of a no-brainer, really. And one more important note to make with oxalic acid is that the vapor will not penetrate the cappings of the broods. You heard me talk about the break in the brood cycle and why I wanted to treat then. The brood is going to be capped around day 9 for workers, day 11 for drones. So you're going to have about 12 to 13 days where they are capped and where the treatments would really have no effect on them. So what I used to do historically, I would go ahead and do a treatment on day 1, and then, you know, you like take a day like a Saturday. I would just treat 3 Saturdays in a row. That worked pretty well. But I think I'd like to kind of tighten that up to maybe about 5 days, because you know that the total number of days is 12 or 13 days. So if you do 3 treatments 5 days apart, that's 15 days. You know that there's nothing that was ever uncapped within your treatment cycle. So, you know, I mean, if it's not broke, don't fix it, right? So if 7 days works for you, great. If you can consolidate it down to 5, fine. If you had to do 5 one time, 7 the next, and then 6 the one after, you know, it's not a hard, fast rule, but, you know, maybe an experiment for another day. But I'm also going to kind of bump my dosage up a little bit. I was reading not long ago that the recommended dosage, I think, has gone up to like 4 grams per hive. I used to do 1 gram of oxalic acid in the powder form, 1 gram per brood box. So if I was doing a standard, you know, standard 2 deep kind of configuration, I'd have 2 grams. I'm going to bump that to 1.5 grams per brood box. And I'm going to see, again, there's some measuring involved, some testing and keeping track of things. I just want to see if I can get slightly better numbers. My numbers have been really good, but I'd like to say like every year is different. Like every month is different. Every hive is different. I've seen so many times where you'll have like a row of, you know, 10 different colonies and you'll have, you know, 1, 1, 2, 1, 8. Like you have this one colony that just has like 8 per 100. You're like, how did that happen, right? The genetics are different, and that's just the way it is. Now, another thing you've heard me give a hard time with people about in the past is with sticky boards. And the reason I was so tough on them is people were telling me that that was their sole source of assessing mite counts. And I think that it is a tool that can be used. I do not think it is a adequate replacement for a alcohol wash, dish soap wash, sugar shake, whatever you like to do. I don't believe it's an adequate replacement for that. And the last thing I'm bringing in this year is I'm going to be using some sacrificial drone broods. There's some, you know, drone comb frames you can buy, and I'm going to drop those in. And, you know, my hope there is that the queen will lay those things up with a ton of drone brood. And the reason for this is the varroa mite prefers the drone brood. The cells are bigger, and the development cycle of the drone is 2 days longer than the worker. And the varroa mite has evolved to recognize this. So what we're going to do is we're going to put those frames in, let the queen draw up a whole bunch of drone brood. And if you have chickens, this is a great way to reward your chickens, because chickens love eating eating larvae. But you can basically, once all that drone brood is capped, just take it outside and scrape it off for the chickens and let them go to town, and they will love you forever. So that's another thing that we're going to bring in. And again, to be more specific here. So my hope is any remaining mites that are inside the hive post-treatment, I'm hoping that they are drawn to the drone brood, as, because again, people will tell you, if you have the ability to assess drones when you're doing a mite wash, that's even better than workers, because the mites are drawn to them. Anyway, so that's all I've got for you today, folks. Next week, we're going to dive into the real detailed story and history and everything on the Varroa mite. We're going to talk about how it has evolved alongside the Asian honeybee and how it has not with the European honeybee and why that's a challenge. We're going to talk about the common viruses and illnesses that are associated with, like I've said before, the Varroa mite is kind of like the HIV of the honeybee world. It's not the Varroa mite itself that always kills the bee. It's the it weakens the immune system and makes them more susceptible to other illnesses. So we're going to go through all those other illnesses and talk about things that you can look for and how you can figure out what you should do and how to address it and all that good stuff. So take care, be kind to one another, and remember that I love you. And there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.